I think I just need to take Nathan with me whenever I go speak somewhere because he reminds me of just a big, manly, strong cheerleader getting everybody pumped up before a good day of talking about, I think, very important things. If you were here last night, we talked about creation versus evolution. That was the title of the lesson. And we talked about two of the most fundamental questions that we could ask, and that is, where did everything come from that exists in the universe, and where did life come from? If you were not able to be here with us last night, I think that they have a audio recording of that lesson, so please feel free to talk to Don or Nathan or someone about a recording of that. We also, in that lesson, talked about the law of cause and effect and the law of biogenesis, and how both of them, even quoting numerous evolutionists, indicate that evolution has a problem with those two laws, and those two laws of science have a problem with the theory of evolution, especially the law of biogenesis as well as the law of cause and effect. And then in the second lecture last night, we talked about how design demands a designer. We spent several minutes giving various examples of all of the design in the universe, on planet Earth, in the human body, and also among certain animal creatures. And so we are glad to be able to talk about those kinds of things. Today we're kind of moving on. Every one of the lectures in this seminar series, every one of the lectures stands alone, but I think they also really build off of each other when you're able to start from the very beginning of lesson one, where we talked about the two most fundamental questions I believe someone could ask. In this lecture, we're going to continue talking about the theory of evolution. And by way of reminder, and for those of you who were not here last night, as we introduced to you our understanding of evolution, I want to quote two evolutionists who defined evolution for us. I don't know when they wrote about evolution, if they were trying to give us a definition for all time, but these two statements have been very well accepted among both evolutionists and creationists as just kind of an understanding of what people mean by the theory of evolution. And so you're going to recognize these two quotations if you were here last night. And please, Don, go ahead and feel free to turn the lights down. George A. Kirkut's 1960 explanation or definition of evolution is, "There is a theory that all living forms in the world have arisen from a single source, which itself came from an inorganic form. This theory can be called the general theory of evolution." And then Dr. George Gaylord Simpson, in the same year in Science magazine, made a statement that is that has been well received as far as a definition of the theory of evolution. And I think it's been well received, or it's been accepted by many people, because number one, it's kind of a short, succinct statement, and number two, because of who Dr. George Gaylord Simpson was and how he was respected in the evolutionary community. He said that evolution is a fully natural process. Again, last night we kind of showed the contrast between naturalistic explanations for our origins versus a supernaturalistic, outside of nature, outside of the material universe explanation for this. He says evolution is a fully natural process inherent in the physical properties of the universe by which life arose in the first place, and by which all living things, past or present, have since developed divergently and progressively. We showed this poster last night as kind of one of the ways that people illustrate the theory of evolution. Now, in the last few decades, we have heard a lot more about evolution not simply being a hypothesis or a theory, but really being more of a fact. I made this statement a few years ago when I was allowed to go back to my hometown of Muskogee, Oklahoma. I don't live there now, but that's where I lived most of my growing up years, from first grade through 12th grade. I got to go back there and teach in the public high school for about 6 hours one day, and I talked some about the theory of evolution, how many people have just considered it now a fact, a proven fact, and not just a hypothesis or a theory. And one of the young ladies in the class, who seemed to be a pro-evolution in her thinking, said, "Well, people don't call evolution a fact. They just refer to it as a theory." And I said, "Well, actually, that's not the case. Some of the most well-known evolutionists of last century and this century are calling evolution more than just a theory. They are calling it a fact. Consider W.W. Howells and Mankind So Far, 1944. This was several years ago. He said evolution is a fact like digestion. Just as you were digesting what you had for breakfast or what you had for lunch, supposedly that is how factual evolution is." Now, mind you, you can have a doctor inspect your body. He can know what is going on in your body. He can see the digestion going on in your body. If he opens you up, or if he performs various types of scans on you or whatever. Well, that is factual, and supposedly that is how factual evolution is. Evolution of the animal and plant world is considered by all those entitled to a judgment to be a fact for which no further proof is needed, wrote Richard Goldschmidt in 1952. Evolution, now get this, is of the animal and plant world is considered by all those entitled to a judgment to be a fact. Now, I don't know if you can pick up on the arrogance in that statement, but you probably should be able to. Those who are entitled to a judgment understand evolution to be a fact. Well, if we don't understand it that way, are we not entitled to our judgments? The fact of the matter is there are many brilliant people around the world who do not believe that the theory of evolution is a fact. Julian Huxley wrote in 1960, "The first point to make about Darwin's theory, that is Charles Darwin's theory, is that it is no longer a theory, but a fact. No serious scientist would deny the fact that evolution has occurred. Supposedly no serious scientist believe in creation. No serious scientist doubts the factuality of evolution, and that simply is not a true statement. Again, there are thousands of scientists around the world. They don't get near as much press as the atheistic evolutionists. They aren't given government grants near as much as the atheistic evolutionists, but there are thousands of them around. I work with several of them at Apologetics Press, who some of them who have worked full-time with us in the past, many of them who are writing for us and holding various positions around the country in universities. One of them has been working with NASA for several years. Another one is, we have one at Fried Hardeman University who's teaching cell biology there, one at David Lipscomb University who is in the one of the science departments there, or the science department, and his specialty is biochemistry. They're scientists all over the world who do not hold to this theory, but some of the most well-known evolutionists of last century have stated that evolution is more than just a theory, but it is a fact. B.B. Vance and D.F. Miller wrote in their book, Biology for You, saying all reputable biologists have agreed that evolution of life on Earth is an established fact. It seems to me that the criteria for whether a biologist is reputable or not is whether they what? Well, if they believe in evolution, they seem to be reputable, and if they don't, it seems to me the implication here is, well, they're not reputable. But again, there are many, many biologists around the world with PhDs in cell biology and microbiology and all sorts of disciplines of science who do not believe in evolution, and especially not atheistic evolution. Jay Savage wrote in 1965, notice the progression in the dates that I'm giving you, said that no serious biologist today doubts the fact of evolution. The fact of evolution is amply clear. And Stephen Jay Gould, a name you probably recognize from last century, wrote in 1980 in Newsweek magazine, "Evolution is a fact like apples falling out of trees." Apples fall out of trees. I know that because I used to pick apples at a peach orchard and apple orchard back in Oklahoma in the 100 and 105 degree heat of the summer that is not quite like the heat out here in California. We sweat, it seems like, a whole lot more in Oklahoma and down in Alabama where I live now. Well, supposedly this is how factual evolution is. Apples falling out of trees, just like the food that you're digesting right now. All reptobiologists believe in the factuality of evolution. And then we have a quotation that I believe I read for you last night by Stephen Jay Gould in 1999, who said, "Evolution is as well documented as any phenomenon in science as strongly as the Earth's revolution around the sun, rather than vice versa. In this sense, we can call evolution a fact." Michael LePage wrote in 2008, just last year, in New Scientist magazine, "Evolution is as firmly established a scientific fact as the roundness of the Earth." And then just one more quotation regarding the alleged factuality of this theory. The U.S. News and World Report cover back just a few years ago said the new reality of evolution, where we came from, where we're going. Now, we discussed this question last night, and I'm telling you, evolution does not have a factual, backed up by facts kind of answer for where we came from, where everything came from. It's certainly not proven And in this, Thomas Hayden wrote, this was in 2002, "By now, scientists say evolution is no longer just a theory. It's an everyday phenomenon, a fundamental fact of biology, as real as hunger and as unavoidable as death." Back just a few years ago, the Cobb County School Board in Cobb County, Georgia, they adopted new science textbooks for their schools. And several of the parents in that county became bothered by the fact that in these particular science textbooks that they adopted, the theory of evolution was promoted more than they had ever seen it in their textbooks, more as factual and not just as a theory. And so my understanding was, or is, that many of the parents in that county, they decided to get a petition together, and they petitioned the school board, many hundreds of signatures, perhaps even thousands, if I remember correctly, so that it wasn't long until the school board decided to do something. And what the school board did doesn't seem like that big of a deal, at least it didn't when I first heard the story, and, you know, looking back on it, they decided to put a sticker in the front of these textbooks, in these science textbooks. And here's what the sticker said. In fact, this is a copy of one of the stickers. "The textbook, this textbook, science textbook, contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered." This is the sticker that they adopted back in March of 2002. The problem with the sticker, apparently, is that it's unconstitutional. The problem seems to me that so many people have accepted evolution as factual that they don't want a sticker put in the front of science textbooks that says evolution is a theory and not a fact regarding the origin of living things. It wasn't long after this sticker was adopted that the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, filed a lawsuit seeking the Cobb County School Board to remove the stickers from the textbooks. And then, in April 2004, a federal judge refused to dismiss the lawsuit because the disclaimer, quote, "could have the effect of advancing religion." He stated, "While the disclaimer has no biblical reference, it encourages students to consider alternatives other than evolution." So, a federal judge in Atlanta, Georgia said, "Hey, you know what? We're going to allow this to go to trial." And one of the reasons we're going to allow this to go to trial is because this sticker might have the effect of advancing religion. Did you see the sticker? Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. Approach this study, just summarizing the sticker, approach the study of this matter with an open mind. Study it carefully, critically consider it. And yet a federal judge says, wait just a minute, this could be advancing religion. And we sure wouldn't want that in America, would we? In the United States of America, when you go back and read the founding fathers' statements, many of them, dozens of them, if you were here last year for Dave Miller's seminar that he held about a year ago, he probably showed you dozens, if not hundreds, of statements by our founding forefathers who acknowledged the true and the living God, who acknowledged His creation, who acknowledged His providence. But now in America, things have changed really drastically since that time. Now, according to the ACLU, you should not even be able to put a sticker in the front of textbooks that doesn't mention God, that doesn't mention Jesus, that doesn't mention the Bible, that does not mention Christianity, but that says evolution's a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. Well, the judge stated in January of 2005, my understanding was this was after the trial, "Due to the manner in which the sticker refers to evolution as a theory, the sticker also has the effect of undermining evolution education to the benefit of those Cobb County citizens who would prefer that students maintain their religious beliefs regarding the origin of life." But wait a minute, the sticker didn't have anything to say about religion. It didn't have anything to say about creation. Nothing about Christianity. It was about evolution. And it seems to me that one of the reasons that we have a lecture series like this is simply because my experience has taught me that rarely does a good critique or do criticisms about the theory of evolution get to be brought up in classrooms all around this country. There seems to be, to me, to be a kind of a stifling of this. And so a lot of people have resorted to teaching their children at home about these matters or teaching them in a church building or somewhere else because so much of the time the critiques and the criticisms of the theory of evolution are not getting taught to young people. And so we have even a federal judge saying, well, you know what, this, we're just going to allow people who, you know, hold their religious views at home and not put a sticker like this in textbooks. The U.S. District Judge Clarence Cooper went on to say, and these quotations, I have documentation for all the quotations. This one came from, if I remember correctly, a news story that was either on USA Today or Fox News. And I have the court documents from this court case in our office back in Montgomery, Alabama. He ruled that the sticker also has the effect of implicitly bolstering alternative religious theories of origins by suggesting that evolution is a problematic theory even in the field of science. By denigrating evolution, the school board appears to be endorsing the well-known prevailing alternative theory, creationism or variations thereof, even though the sticker does not specifically reference any alternative theories. He admitted the sticker doesn't offer alternative theories. And my question is, why can't we critique a theory? Why is it always, well, you know, you're just religious or you're a Christian and you just don't like this? Well, can we set that aside for just a moment and just critique the theory for what it is? If we're going to teach kids that a Big Bang occurred 14 billion years ago that caused the universe to come into existence and that inflation that occurred just after the Big Bang, if that's going to be taught in textbooks, well, can we at least ask questions about it and critique it and ask ourselves, is it proven? Can we put up quotations like we did last night from one of the foremost astrophysicists in the world, Dr. Peter Coles, who believes in Big Bang Theory, but also says, you know what, we haven't proved any of this. Those were the quotations we showed last night from him, from New Scientist magazine. Can we put quotations up regarding the problems with spontaneous generation, with life coming from non-life, if it's true, if evolution is true, that had to have happened millions of years ago? But wait a minute, the foremost evolutionists, one of them anyway, on the origin of life from an evolutionary perspective, we quoted last night from his 24-lesson lecture series produced by the teaching company, who said, you know what, we haven't proved any of this. We don't know for sure. We've never seen it happen in nature. We're just saying it did because we're making an assumption. Evolution's not a fact. It is a theory, and yet you can't put a sticker in the front of textbooks that says it's a theory because you might be advancing religion. I believe full well, just like I have done in various, not many, but in a few public schools around the country and in several private schools, that I can go in there and teach about science and teach about problems with evolutionary theory without ever mentioning God, without ever mentioning the Bible, to do what they did with the sticker and say, hey, you know, I think kids need to be able to ask questions. They need to be able to look at things openly and critically and carefully. What's wrong with that? You know, as Christians, that's what we're supposed to do. People who are Christians and don't look at things carefully or critically or examine things thoroughly, well, I don't think we're being really the kind of Christians that Jesus wants us to be. He doesn't want us to just have a religion, a fly-by-night kind of religion that's just, well, you know, my great-great-great-great-granddaddy believed this, and my great-great-great-great-granddaddy, and my granddaddy, and my daddy all believe this, and so that's what I'm going to believe. No, that's just a blind faith. That's not the kind of faith that Jesus and the apostles and the New Testament, Old Testament writers want us to have, as we quoted last night from various places in Scripture, not to prove the existence of God, but simply to prove the point that we are to think rationally. We are to think carefully. We are to think critically. And when people ask us questions, we need to try to answer some of their questions, although the fact of the matter is we're finite creatures. We don't have an answer to every question. Some of you may have questions here today that, you know, I don't know, I certainly don't know all the answers to. I get questions on a regular basis where I work. And some of my answers are, well, I don't know the answer to this. But what we do know, we need to try to be able to help people to answer. And also, the fact of the matter is, there are some answers that we might be able to give to people's questions that people will never accept. There are good answers to a lot of questions that are out there, but some people really will never accept the answers that you give them. And we may think sometimes as Christians, those of us who are here today as Christians, we may think we have failed because we didn't cause someone to believe. Well, that's not my job, it's not your job to cause, to make someone to believe. It's our job to do the best we can at teaching people, do the best we can at offering people various lines of evidence for what we're trying to talk about. Well, this was a very controversial subject, and I wanted to show you this as we talk about this lecture on problems with evolutionary theory, because from the outset I want you to see that there are many who are saying it's factual. There are others who are saying, wait a minute, it's not factual. And so I wanted us to look at, well, what does the evidence have to show about it? This was ruled by a U.S. District Court judge in Atlanta, Georgia, as being unconstitutional just a few years ago. Well, if it is unconstitutional, that evolution is more than just a theory. What is the evidence for this? I have with me a book called Evolution, Change Over Time. We have several, probably dozens, if I recall correctly, of science textbooks from middle school to high school to college age, young people, their textbooks we have in our offices, and we've gone through and we've looked at them and we've checked out what all they're saying, and we have written a lot of articles and books and various things about the problems that are in these textbooks. And I want to show you in a textbook for middle schoolers that's right out about 100 pages. This textbook came from Graves County, Kentucky. It was published in the mid-1990s, but it was even being used in classrooms up until the late 90s and even the early part of the 21st century. This one came from Graves County, Kentucky. It's been used in Alabama, not only in Kentucky, but also Alabama. I've seen the same page layout that's in this. It looks like about a 9-week study book that's been in this book, also in various textbooks that have been made out on the West Coast. And so this is pretty basic information that people have used all over the country. Now, what are some, you know, if you only have 100 pages or so to teach middle schoolers about the theory of evolution, well, what are you going to tell them about evolution? Well, one of the examples that you will see repeatedly in textbooks, it's been in textbooks for decades now, for at least 2 or 3 or 4 decades, is the story about the English peppered moth. And the story, if I can summarize it, goes something like this. Before the Industrial Revolution took place in England back several decades ago, the darker colored moths, the lighter colored moths made up, wait just a second, I think I need to back up here for just a minute. Okay, before the Industrial Revolution, this is right, took place in England, the lighter colored moths made up a greater percentage of the English moth peppered, the English peppered moths population. And the reasoning that was given was, well, because they blended in with the tree trunks more than the darker colored moths. Because the tree trunks were covered with light lichens, and the lighter colored English peppered moths supposedly blended in with the tree trunks more, and the darker colored moths were more easily seen, and so the birds were able to see the darker colored moths more easily, and they ate them, and so you had the lighter colored English peppered moths outnumbering the darker colored moths. Well, after the Industrial Revolution took place, and after many factories were built, and chimneys, and soot was coming out of those chimneys and covering the trees and so forth, then you have the trees changing color. And you have them becoming darker, and so it was reported that you had a greater number then of the darker colored moths that were blending in with the tree trunks, and a lot less of the lighter colored moths that were not blending in with the tree trunks anymore because they were now being covered with black soot. This is a page from a 1978 science textbook that deals with this story. And it talks about how these creatures rest on tree trunks during the day. And the story goes that, well, the birds saw them more easily, kind of like I just told you. They even had young people kind of doing a little bit of an activity where they take black paper and they put black moss or black pieces of paper that were supposed to be moss down and lighter colored moss. And this is kind of an example, supposedly, of evolution by natural selection. And this is page 61 of this textbook that was produced nearly 20 years ago. After the one you see on the screen behind me. And here's how the story goes here. Because the gray moths were almost the same color as the tree trunks on which they lived, they were nearly invisible to the birds that hunted them for food. As more factories were built in the area, soot from chimneys blackened the tree trunks. The gray moths could now be seen against the tree trunks. The few surviving black moths, however, now blended in with the tree trunks. As a result, they survived. After the start of the Industrial Revolution, the light gray bark of the trees was darkened by the soot from factories. In the photograph, and then they ask the question, which peppered moth is more easily seen? This covers about one entire page of a 100-page book on evolution. It's supposedly an example of evolution. Well, it has some problems with this example. Dr. Kettlewell from Oxford, England, introduced this story back in about 1955 as evidence for evolution by natural selection. Since then, however, it's appeared in many, many textbooks as evidence for evolution. However, the problem is these moths do not live or rest on tree trunks, at least not normally. Only two of these, from what I have found out, only two of these moths have been seen on tree trunks in the past 40 years. Kettlewell actually glued two dead moths on a tree trunk to take a photograph. That's now become very famous. There's no evidence of what Kettlewell proposed back several decades ago. You know, what happens today if we were to do a science experiment, if we were going to come up with a hypothesis and then do an experiment, and we reported results and we told the world that these were our results and here are the conclusions that we're basing upon the results. But then for the next several decades, people had done that same experiment and no one came to the same conclusions that we came to. What would happen to our conclusions? What would happen to the conclusion of the guy's experiment that we were imitating? Well, they would be rejected. For whatever reason, this has been in textbooks for a number of years. And number two, his results, as I've just stated, have not been replicated. And so this is, and has been in textbooks, in taxpayer-paid textbooks, for decades. And yet, as the story is told in the textbooks, it's not correct. They do not rest normally on tree trunks. They do not live on tree trunks. And that's what you read right here in a 1978. They rest on tree trunks, or they live on tree trunks right here in the textbook that was published in the mid-90s. Now, we have to ask ourselves a question. Well, why is this in the textbooks? There was a Canadian textbook writer named Bob Ritter who was asked this question. Jonathan Wells reports on this in his book, The Icons of Evolution. And he said, well, you have to look at the audience. How convoluted do you want to make it for the first-time learner? That is, evolution. How complicated do you want it to be for young people? So you show them examples of things like the English peppered moth. Well, I'm sorry, I just don't buy putting examples of alleged general theory of evolution type examples that really, as you tell the story in the textbooks, it's not correct the way you tell it. And rationalize putting it in there because it's easy for kids to be able to see this or understand that. If I'm a young person, I would be offended by this statement that I can't handle the truth about the matter or that I'm going to be told here are examples of evolution when really the way they're telling them, it's not quite correct. He went on to say the advantage of this example of natural selection is that it is extremely visual. Yes, it is visual, at least the way they tell it and the way they show pictures of it in the textbooks. But just because it's visual doesn't make it right. I could tell you that my oldest son is going to be the greatest basketball player that ever lives because I came home from work the other day and saw him on the top of my house. And I conclude that he jumped up there. And so he's got a vertical leap of about 14 feet. Well, you know, that's kind of visual. I could see, you know, picture him on top of the roof of the house and give me a heart attack as I drive home and see him up there. But, you know, what we later find out is that he climbed up a ladder and he was up there on the roof, kind of similar to how someone might glue English peppered moss on tree trunks. Well, it can be visual, but that doesn't make it right. Well, he went on to say that we want to get across the idea of selective adaptation or natural selection. Later on, they, high school students, can look at the work critically. So we're going to basically, you know, teach them this now, though it may not be quite right, because it kind of teaches natural selection or selective adaptation, and they can learn, you know, more of the story later. Part of the problem is they're not learning more of the story later, at least from what I can tell, because there are many textbooks, even college textbooks that you see on the screen behind me, published as recently as the year 2000, that still have the same story in there. And it's been in there for years. There are people, even Christians, who study to be biology teachers, who have sat in classrooms and heard this and read this, and they go to college and read it again, and they go back home and they teach it in their school systems, and they've never heard, well, you know what, there really are some problems with this example. And my other question, I guess, is, I don't understand how this, as we began the lecture, we quoted from two of the most famous evolutionists of last century. They define the general theory of evolution for us. And I don't know how this defends that, how this proves the general theory of evolution. English peppered moss, they might change some in that, well, this number may outnumber, this moth may outnumber this moth over a period of time. There's a change in the population. The fact of the matter is they're still moss. They're still English peppered moss. They still have the genetic makeup to be English peppered moss. Are there small changes that take place all around us? Most certainly. Do Christians deny that changes take place? Do Christians deny that evolution on a small scale takes place? I don't know of any that do. We believe that changes take place. I tell you one thing, I'm changing right now. I'm getting bigger. Okay? I can tell I'm getting bigger. My pants. Listen, I went in the other day, my mom bought me a suit for my 34th birthday the other day. She bought me size 34 pants. I thought I wore size 34, 35 pants. I had to take them back and get a size 38. I didn't know what was going on. I'm just hoping they have a different, you know, way people fit pants and this and that. I don't know. But we're changing. There are a lot of changes that take place around us. Dogs change a lot, you know. I've got two mutts in my backyard. They're half Airedale and half something else. I don't know how many of you have had different kinds of dogs or different varieties of dogs, but there are a lot of them out there. My niece brought home a dog a few years ago. It looked more like a rat than a dog. A long-haired rat, just about. She called it a Maltipoo. I mean, she still has that thing, but it's a mess. I don't know if you've ever had a Maltipoo before. My understanding was, a few hundred years ago, there were no Maltipoos. They finally mixed Maltese with poodles, and now we have Maltipoos. You may have heard of Peek-a-poos and Cock-a-poos. There are a lot of different kinds of dogs around. There are a lot of different varieties of cattle today. Now, I ate at a steakhouse in Jasper, Alabama some years ago called the Brangus Steakhouse. My understanding is that it's not logically possible for that steakhouse to have existed more than 110 years ago because there were no Brangus cows back then. Why? Well, the geneticists and others had not yet gotten the Angus cows with the Brahman cows, and now we have Brangus cows. Hey, we believe in change, in that there are changes that take place within the cow kind, within the dog kind, within humankind. I mean, you have some humans that have small heads, some humans that have big heads, some humans that are hairy, some humans that are less hairy, some humans with big noses, some humans with small noses. I have a hard time understanding when I see a picture of Neanderthal man up on the screen and they say, well, this was your ancestor who lived, you know, back 100 years ago. They made Neanderthals, or not 100 years ago, maybe a little less than that. But a lot of times evolutionists would make Neanderthals look more ape-like. And now Neanderthals, they make them look to be more human-like. And when I see a picture of a Neanderthal, I think, you know, I think I have family members with heads at about that size and noses about that size. Seems to me that they just seem to be, if there's a lot of variation today within humanity, that there would have been variation 100, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 years ago. My point is, changes take place. We believe in change. The difference, from what I can tell, between creationists and evolutionists, one of the differences is, creationists believe in change, but we believe that change has limits. We believe that you're going to have a lot of varieties within the dog kind, a lot of varieties within the cat kind, a lot of varieties within humankind, but that we've never seen humans come from apes or ape-like creatures. We've never seen dogs change into anything other than dogs. And we've never seen English peppered moths change into anything other than English peppered moths. And so I'm sorry, but I don't understand, even if the story was true that they purport in the textbooks, I don't understand why it would be in textbooks, because all of us believe that changes take place. We all understand that natural selection takes place. That when you see a fast lion, if he's going to go after a slow gazelle, well, he's going to eat that, he's going to catch and eat that gazelle, and you have, in a way, natural selection taking place all the time. It's been going on for centuries, for millennia. So we have several examples that either, number one, are not of alleged evolution, number one, that are not told correctly, and number two, we have a hard time understanding why in the world they would use this as an example to prove the general theory of evolution. What's another example of supposed proof of evolution. Well, Ernst Haeckel lived several years ago. He said that the turning point in his thinking was when he read Charles Darwin's Origin of Species back in 1860. Now, Ernst Haeckel was famous for coming up with the idea known as ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. That's a long phrase. Some of you may have heard it before. All it means is he came up with the idea that here's proof for evolution, that inside the mother's embryo, or inside the mother, the human embryo goes through stages, retraces our alleged evolutionary ancestor stages. That at one point, the baby looks like more worm-like. At another point, looks more fish-like. At another point, looks more reptilian-like. At another point, more mammal-like. This was kind of the story that he purported. In fact, these were his illustrations, where he illustrated how various animals, and then eventually the human, goes through the stages, evolutionary stages, of the animals and humans' alleged forefathers. And so, as the story goes, a human goes through a fish stage that has gill slits, and then it goes through an anthropoid stage where it has a tail, and then eventually, by the time the human is about ready to be born, it's now a human. And this was presented as proof for the general theory of evolution. Now, you can also see, those of you who are pro-life, and I certainly believe that all Christians should be pro-life. You know, to me, the cruelty that we see going on in this nation, where millions and millions of children over the past 30-something years have been slaughtered, well, I believe that's an unbelievable cruelty and a blight on this nation. And I believe that God exists, and I believe that God is very disappointed and sad and angry with the leaders of this country who pass those kinds of laws, or the judges who make this to be okay to be done in America. Well, you can imagine how people who want to say it's okay to abort children would like to believe this, whether they do or not. They would like to believe that, well, maybe they're not really all human, and so we can get rid of them, discard them fairly easily. The problem with Ernst Haeckel's story, one of the problems, is his pictures were wrong. You see, he didn't take pictures of the animals at these various stages. He didn't take pictures of the human embryo at this stage or this stage. He drew them. He drew them how he wanted to draw them. And there's proof today that his drawings had major problems in them. They were discovered during the time in which he lived, and he was confronted with them. Here are the actual pictures of these animals and the human at the stages that he supposedly drew them. Now, before we go on, let me just show you that on pages 53 and 54 of a textbook called Evolution, Change Over Time, this is presented as evidence of evolution. Let me go back to the previous slide. You see the pictures behind me. On the top left-hand corner of this textbook, you have very similar images. Let me read to you what this particular textbook has to say, again, that students have used all over this country just a few years ago. As you can see, the embryos of a fish, chicken, rabbit, and human appear almost identical in their early stages. What does this mean? Now, let me stop right there for just a moment and say this. Even if they were nearly identical at the early stages, even if we did look very similar to these animals at early stages, even if today the hand of a human resembles the wing of a bat or the paw of a dog or whatever similarities that people try to make between humans and animals, even if that's the case, my contention is that doesn't prove that we came from monkeys. I could just as easily say, I believe in a creator God, and he made things very similar. Why did he do that? Well, I'll tell you why. Because we breathe the same air, because we drink the same liquids, water, because we walk on the same terrain. And so, does it make sense to me that God would have made various animals and even some humans to have some similar structures? We have bones, we have lungs, we have eyes, we have all sorts of similarities. Does that mean we evolved? No, that doesn't prove that. Just like if I offer that as proof for the existence of God, I don't offer that as proof because I don't believe that it necessarily proves that. My point is, similarities in and of themselves do not prove one theory or the other. And yet it's offered as proof in the science textbooks as proof of evolution. Similarities in the embryos of different organisms indicate that these organisms share a common ancestor. That is, these organisms all share a common heritage. Where's the proof? Well, the proof is right here, supposedly, that you have similarities in the various stages of embryo development. The similarities in the early stages of embryo development are further evidence that living things have evolved from earlier living things and that many living things share a common ancestor. The fact of the matter is, it doesn't prove that. They might want to put pictures up next to each other and say, this proves evolution, but how is it that just mere similarities prove that? Well, it does not. Furthermore, his drawings turned out to be wrong. And let me read you some statements from evolutionists on this point, including Dr. Stephen Jay Gould, who wrote an article called Atrocious just a few years ago. Here is what he had to say about Ernst Haeckel's theory from more than 100 years ago. He said, Haeckel remains most famous today as the chief architect and propagandist for a most famous argument that science disproved long ago, that the popular culture has never fully abandoned, including textbooks like this one right here. He went on to say in the article, we should therefore not be surprised that Haeckel's drawings entered 19th century textbooks, but we do, I think, have the right to be both astonished and ashamed by a century of mindless recycling. This isn't a creationist saying this. This is one of the foremost evolutionists of last century. That has led to the persistence of these drawings in a large number, if not majority, of modern textbooks. If evolution is a fact, and they're going to teach young people about evolution in school, why, in just a 100-page textbook that's full of pictures, that you would have now nearly 3 pages of text devoted to the English peppered moth, Ernst Haeckel's theory of embryonic recapitulation? And let me read you a statement that was made even before Stephen Jay Gould made this one years ago. Here is a statement in a book called The Human Body by Sir Arthur Keith. That goes back to 1932. This is how long we've understood this to be false. He said, it was expected, that is by evolutionists, that the embryo would recapitulate or retrace the features of its ancestors from the lowest to the highest forms in the animal kingdom. That is, at one point the embryo looked like more like a fish, at another point like a monkey and so forth. Now that the appearance of the embryo at all stages is known, the general feeling is one of disappointment. Why is that the case? Because it doesn't prove it. The human embryo at no stage is anthropoid in appearance. The embryo of the mammal never resembles the worm, the fish, or the reptile. Embryology provides no support whatsoever for evolution, for the evolutionary hypothesis. Now, these men know a whole lot more about this subject matter than I do. I'm quoting you their words, I believe, as just them being authoritative on the matter. Why do we still have this in textbooks as supposed proof of evolution if it does not prove evolution? Well, I believe this shows problems with evolutionary theory, problems that we have known about for decades, and as the evolutionist Stephen Jay Gould said, what's part of the problem? The problem is a century of mindless recycling that takes place even in textbooks that you paid for. And by the way, the story has even been in later textbooks than this one right here, as recently as the year 2000, and I haven't looked at some of the ones that have been published since about 2004. They probably still have them in there. How many of you remember being taught the theory of evolution using the horse family tree? You know, we are told, even in recent times in Scientific American, a pro-evolutionary atheistic magazine, that a sequence of fossils spans the evolution of modern horses from the tiny Eohippus all the way up to the modern horse. There supposedly is a sequence of fossils that proves this. Now you hopefully understand that fossilologists, paleontologists and others, that they don't just go out into the rocks and just see a fossil and see how there is a line drawn from one animal to another animal. They simply see a lot of fossils and they make judgments. Well, this animal was this animal's ancestor. This animal was this animal's forefather. This animal was a descendant of this animal, and it's been alleged for decades now that, you know, you have a nice kind of horse family tree that allegedly proves evolution. Notice what George Gaylord Simpson said back in the 1950s. He said, the uniform continuous transformation of Hyracotherium into Equus, Hyracotherium is the same as Eohippus, into Equus, that is the modern horse, so dear to the hearts of generations of textbook writers, never happened. in nature. And my contention is it hasn't been proved to have happened even since the 1950s. Stephen Jay Gould said in his article called Atrocious, the one we quoted from just a few minutes ago, he said, once ensconced in textbooks, misinformation becomes cocooned and effectively permanent. Because as stated above, textbooks copy from previous texts. I have written two essays on this lamentable practice. One on the amusingly perennial description of Eohippus or Don Horse. Folks, this was written in the year 2000 by an evolutionist who said it's the size of a fox hair, even though most authors, including yours truly, have no idea of the dimensions or appearance of this breed. Notice, he says, one of the amusingly perennial description of the Eohippus or Don Horse, that this is one of the sad practices in science textbooks. I don't find anything funny about it, that this continues to be in textbooks or was for several decades. And many of the most well-known evolutionists in the world, including Dr. Stephen Jay Gould, said, wait a minute, this hasn't been proven, to summarize his words. And yet it was talked about in a National Geographic article as recently as November 2004, where they referred to a vaguely horse-like creature known as Hyracotherium, or Eohippus. In 1954, Herbert Nielsen made this statement about the alleged evolution of horses. He said, the family tree of the horse is beautiful and continuous, only in the textbooks. In the reality provided by the results of research, it is put together from three parts, of which only the last can be described as including horses. The forms of the first part are just as much little horses as present-day daimons or horses. And basically, those things that they say horses evolved from, they're no more horses than today's dogs or horses. The construction of the horse is therefore a very artificial one, since it is put together from non-equivalent parts and cannot therefore be a continuous transformation series. What we have seen is that in the last, I don't know, I'm guessing about the last 10 or 15 years or so, that you don't see as much about horse evolution in textbooks. I'm not going to say that no science textbooks have anything about horse evolution in them anymore. I'm saying the appearance to me has been, in my review of a lot of different textbooks, is that they don't use horse evolution as proof of evolution as much anymore. You see a lot more use of camels as proof of evolution. Notice, here is a page from one particular textbook. Not the one I'm holding up, but it just so happens that on page 51, taking up about two-thirds or three-fourths of this page, is an illustration of alleged camel evolution. Well, where is the proof of this? Well, they have one statement over to the side that says, the diagram shows the fossil record of the past 65 million years in the evolution of the camel. Well, where's the proof that the camel evolved from something that looks kind of like Fido down here? Where's the proof of that? There is no proof. People interpret the fossils as, well, here is a fossil of a small mammal that lived, they say, what is it here, actually? Well, about 65 million years ago. And then they claim that this animal eventually evolved into the camel. And my point is, there's no proof of that. That is their theory. That is what they believe or want to believe, and that's what they want us to believe. But I don't see any proof in here for it other than a nice little diagram. And that's what we seem to get a lot in regards to proof of so-called human evolution. I showed you this cover last night, How Apes Became Human. You know, certain ones in the media are very good at selling the theory of evolution as fact. I mean, can you get any more factual than this? How apes became human. You know, as with the article last night I showed you, What Put the Bang in the Big Bang? When I see titles like this, I'm very much intrigued by them. I want to know, well, what are they going to say, put the bang in the Big Bang? I'm curious to find out what they're going to say. Well, last night, as we showed you, they didn't tell us. In fact, they just admitted that, well, really, we don't have any proof for this, and so on and so on. Well, how did apes become human? They put an illustration, not a picture. Recall, there were no cameras during the time when we supposedly evolved from apes or ape-like creatures, so there are no pictures of our alleged ape-like ancestors. They're just illustrations, scientific illustrations or recreations of what our ancestors supposedly look like. So where is the proof that apes became human? Well, here's the proof down here. His name's Ardipithecus Romatus Cadaba. They put his face on the cover of Time magazine. Then they do a two-page spread in Time, and they say the discovery of a handful of bones in Ethiopia brings scientists tantalizingly close. You have to make this interesting because paleontology, it's, you know, looking for bones, three or four fragments of bones over a period of several years and some dirt, just, I don't know, I need a little more action. But so you get words like tantalizingly closer to the time 6 million years ago when our most ancient ancestors took their first upright steps, a look at the juncture when chimps and man went their separate evolutionary ways. Now, they have a nice cover on Time magazine. They have a two-page spread of what our ancestors supposedly looked like millions of years ago. But notice one of the statements found on page 56 of this article. In all, the team, that is the team of scientists, eventually found 11 specimens, fossil specimens, from at least 5 different individuals in a cluster of sites. 11 fossil specimens from different individuals in a cluster of sites, and they give this information in some form to a scientific illustrator and say, draw what this creature looked like. And we're going to tell everyone that this is our ancestor, one of our ancestors that lived approximately 6 million years ago. Again, you know, as I read articles like this, I'm looking for the proof. Is the proof in the pudding? Is the proof in the claim? Is it just a theory or is it a fact? Did we really come from apes? Or is it just their interpretation of some of the fossils that they find? Notice, they seem very sure that we came from these creatures. I mean, they drew them, they had them put on the cover, they had a two-page layout. Where's the information? Where's the evidence? Well, 11 fossil specimens. Now, that's not a lot of fossil specimens to draw a picture of one of our ape-like ancestors' faces and put it on there, and then nearly a whole body. And where's the hair, by the way? You know, they always make these guys really hairy, but I'm wondering, you know, how they know that this guy was all that hairy. One of the statements in the article is, this toe bone. They found a toe bone. They said this toe bone proves the creature walked on two legs. I'm not a podiatrist. Is that what a foot doctor is, podiatrist? But I understand. I've had some feet pain. Any of you ever had plantar fasciitis, by the way? I never heard of that until a couple years ago. And man, I tell you what, I've had it for about a year and a half in both of my feet. And I've tried this and that. If anybody knows how to cure it, let me know afterwards. But my understanding is we got about 26 bones in each of our feet. 52 bones in a body that has about 204, 206 bones. I can't remember the exact number. Now, nearly one-fourth of all the bones in our body are in our feet. And they said they found one toe bone. And this toe bone proves that the creature, one of our ancestors, supposedly lived 6 million years ago, and we know he's one of our ancestors partly because he walked upright, and we know that because they found one toe bone. Now, notice this statement in the same article. Not only is it the toe bone separated in time by several hundred thousand years, but it was also found some 10 miles away from the rest. So you're telling me they only found 11 fossil specimens to draw one of our ancestors, alleged ancestors. They only found 11 fossil specimens. Some of them, like this toe bone, is separated in time by several hundred thousand years and was found 10 miles away. I have a hard time understanding how this proves human evolution, how this proves we came from apes when one or two fossils are found here, and then there was another site over here where some fossils are found, and then 10 miles away they found a toe bone, and this put all together, you get the cover on Time magazine. And I know I'm simplifying it more than they would want it simplified necessarily, but I'm just saying, I still don't see the evidence for human evolution. I see their interpretation of this, but I do not see the evidence for it. By the way, I don't know if I have the picture again here. No, I don't. You know the picture, the illustration on the cover of Time magazine of a headshot of Ardipithecus Romatus Cadaba? You know how many fossils they had of the head of this guy to draw that kind of picture, to put them on the cover? I mean, to sell it? Listen, you put something on a cover, a lot of people aren't going to read the article, but they see the cover, and they see it says we came from apes, and you know, people, many people will believe that because it's on the cover. They won't read the story. But in the story, what you find out is this. They found one piece of the right mandible, and that was all of the fossil specimens that were found of the head of this creature. One piece of the right mandible, and from that, they drew an entire head of what one of our alleged ancestors looked like. Let me remind you that we've had a lot of problems with alleged proof of human evolution, especially in the last decade. You know, in 1912, this fossil here, this fossil find, was proposed to be the missing link between humans and apes, that is, Piltdown Man. And for 40 years, people thought that, and then 40 years later, scientists discovered that the fossil had been reconstructed from using the skull of a human and the jawbone of an orangutan. Have you heard of Nebraska Man? You know, several years ago, from a fossilized tooth, an entire species was manufactured, supposedly our ancestors. The only problem was the tooth was later to be identified as a tooth from not even a human, not an ape, but an extinct pig. Of course, evolutionists wouldn't use this still as information or proof of human evolution. My point is, human evolution has never been proven. I mean, evolution from frogs to reptiles to lower mammals to ape-like creatures to humans. It's not there. By the way, if you want to go to our website, www.apologeticspress.org, you'll find a free ebook download called The Truth About Human Origins. We also have the book in print where it deals with all of this in much, 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 much greater detail than I'm able to cover it in just this lecture. It was written by two men with PhDs on the subject, one of them in microbiology, one in neurobiology. A few years ago, in 1975, a single alleged collarbone was found in the Libyan desert. The fossil was dated based upon estimates of the fossil marine plankton around. It was dated by evolutionists as being about 5 million years old. The shape of the collarbone indicated, supposedly, that this creature walked upright. This was sold in one particular magazine as proof of human evolution. And yet, a short while later, it was discovered that, in fact, the collarbone was later determined to be a rib bone, and not even of a human, but of a dolphin. As we close, and I know I'm going just a few minutes over this first session, we're going to take about a 5-minute break after we close with this quotation. Let me read to you a quotation by one of the most well-known scientists of last century. He was the paleontologist of the British Museum of Natural History. In the early 1980s, he went to the American Museum of Natural History to speak. And this is a quotation from that speech. He said, "I think always before in my life, when I got up to speak on a subject, I've been confident of one thing, that I know more about it than anybody in the room because I've worked on it. Well, this time it isn't true. I'm speaking on two subjects, evolutionism and creationism. And I believe it's true to say that I know nothing whatever about either of them." This man was an evolutionist. He went on to say, "One of the reasons I started taking this anti-evolutionary view, or let's call it a non-evolutionary view, was that last year I had a sudden realization. For over 20 years I had thought I was working on evolution in some way. One morning I woke up and something had happened in the night and it struck me that I had been working on this stuff for more than 20 years and there was no one thing I knew about it." I appreciated the gentleman's honesty. He went on to say in this speech, "It is quite a shock to learn that one can be misled for so long. Either there was something wrong with me or there was something wrong with evolutionary theory. Naturally, I know there's nothing wrong with me. So for the last few weeks, I've tried putting a simple question to various people and groups. Question is, can you tell me anything you know about evolution? Any one thing that is true?" It was reported, though I don't know if this can be substantiated, it was reported that after he made this statement, a gentleman stood up and said, "I know one thing. I know that we don't need to be teaching this theory as fact to our kids in school." I think he's exactly right. And yet, the sticker that we saw just a few minutes ago was declared unconstitutional. And we can't put a sticker in textbooks that say evolution is a theory and not a fact regarding the origin of living things. We shouldn't approach this. Of course, we should approach this study, as all of our studies, with an open mind, carefully and critically. Thank you for your kind attention this hour. We're going to take